Well, welcome back, you tipsy theologians, you tipsy boys and girls. I'd like to give a huge shout out, big thank you to our sponsor of today's episode, Magic Mind, but more on that a little bit later. You know what, guys? This episode, it's going to be a good episode. Or maybe not. Who's to say? You know, is there a way to judge if something's actually good or not? That's a tough question. And you know I'm going to need a drink for it. Yo. I love that music. You know what? I tried the new theme. Wasn't doing it for me. This, something about that intro, it encapsulates tipsy theology. I think one day I'll probably write my own intro for it. I've played around with some ideas, but nothing that I really liked. The other one just wasn't doing it for me. This one, it just hits that spot for some reason. But hey, today we're going to be drinking. Just like every other episode. Not like this is a novel thing, like, oh, we're going to be drinking today? What? No. Today, we're going to be drinking something that you've probably never heard of before. That sounded like the most hipster thing to say. You've probably never heard of it before. So it's a Chinese spirit. And I'll be honest, it's deadly. This stuff fuels rocket ships. This is what Elon Musk is using to go to Mars. It'll get him there in a minute. So it's a wildly popular drink in China, which is where I first encountered it. I was offered it by someone there, and after being resuscitated, I was like, what the heck was that? What did I drink? And if you've ever tried it, you might not believe me, but I've come to enjoy it. You don't know the name of it, but you do if you've heard that already. It's powerful, but it's also kind of delicious. It's Baijiu. I don't know if that's how you say it. I'm pretty sure that's how you pronounce it. I'm sure anyone who speaks Chinese will be like, that's not how you say it. So I've got a bottle here. It's a range. Like, there's many different kinds. It's not just like, this is the flavor, this is what it is. The alcohol by volume changes drastically, and the taste does as well, like how they, you know, what they do with it. And I want to jump in some history about it too, because it's really kind of interesting to me, because it's like its own thing that, yeah, we don't know much about. So I will say it's funny. It's hard to find here in the U.S., but in China, you can find it anywhere, and it's so cheap. There's expensive ones, but some of them are really cheap. I think the bottle my sister bought for me when she was last there, because of course I ran out of the ones I brought home. They were like $3 or something like that, and anyone who's had it would be like, you just got the worst. And I'm like, yeah, but it was good. And you know, that's what it's all about. Is the price really, is that determining how good something is? Or is it how we experience it? That's some deep questions right there. Some deep questions. Anyway, I got this bottle when I was in New York City last year. I went to Chinatown. I think it was in Chinatown. And I walked into the store and I was like, hey. So I used to study Chinese. Never got good at it. And my pronunciation is terrible. And I only remember like three words, but I remember the important words. And so I walked in there, and the guy, and I think it was like his dad, I don't know. I'm just assuming based on how they were speaking to each other. That guy knew his way around some Baijiu. I walked up and I was looking, they're like, can we help you something? I was like, I'm looking for Baijiu. And the guy just started speaking Chinese. I'm like, ugh. So I picked up a bottle that I thought was Baijiu. And I was like, what did I say? I was like good? I don't remember how to say it in Chinese right now. But all I remember is the guy. Oh, it's like, I was like, Baijiu? Like, how? I think that means good. I'm pretty sure that's right. You can correct me later if you speak Mandarin. Well, the guy looks at the bottle and looks at me. He's like, "Bohao." Like, that's so you're like, that's bad. That's not good. And I was like, okay, like, which one? And then he handed me the one that I have today. And I've tried it before. It wasn't my first time, but it's pretty good. It says, "Blooming peonies embodies prosperity." Pretty good. From the Sichuan Lang. Sichuan. I think it's probably from Sichuan province or something. But yeah, I really like it. It was good. We're going to try some more of it here too. You can hear me live drink it. How exciting. So a little bit of history about it before we go into all of that. So we're going to go all the way back to the first millennia. The Chinese kingdoms have been united into a vast empire throughout which I apologize in advance for all of my pronunciations of all these. The Huangju, sweet grain wine, it reigns supreme under the Han, Tang, Song, and Song. I think those are dynasties. The dynasties, yes. I think so. The sweet grain wine, the Huangju. I probably just insulted someone's mom. Very sorry. Lifts the guides of painters. I did that by accident once, by the way. A friend of mine was trying to teach me some words, like how to introduce myself, and I did. But instead of saying, "Hi, my name's Paul," I said, "Hi, you fat B word." Yeah, luckily they knew I was stupid, so they just laughed it off. But you don't recover from that one very well. And it was their mom. I said that to their mom. I feel like it's that's like a movie. It looks like a TV show. Like, that doesn't happen in real life, but it happened to me. It happened to me. So, all right, so this the sweet grain wine lifts the guides of painters and coaxes words from poets. This is beautiful. Drinking becomes a secular battlefield where Confucianists advocate moderation and Taoists preach enlightenment through drunkenness. I would be a Taoist. I'm joking. I'm joking. It's tipsy theology, not drunken theology. So about the 13th century, the Mongol hordes of Genghis Khan and his disciples smash into China, spread across Central Asia, and descend on the Middle East, where chemists have unlocked the secrets of alcohol distillation. Those wonderful scientists. The chemists. Soon, the conquerors spread distilled spirits throughout the Mongol Khanate. So the Ming Dynasty, 1368, through 1644. The earliest spirits in China were likely some variation of Middle Eastern arak. I don't know what that is. We should figure that out. But China's brewers waste little time. They work quick. Thousands of years. That's not quick. Oh, I should finish the sentence. Thousands of years of folk knowledge are tweaked and refined to incorporate the wine still. The essence of Huangju is extracted, and by the Ming Dynasty, it becomes a potent drink known as Shaoju, or burnt wine. Today, we call it Baijiu. As Baijiu spreads, I can hear everyone cringing every time I say any Chinese word. I can feel it. As it spreads, it adapts and changes by each local tradition and personal taste. The aristocratic elite still prefers quaffing? Drinking Huangju, the old sweet grain wine, while the peasantry prefers the raw power and value of Baijiu. I love just raw power, because it is. It's gasoline. Actually, there is one bottle by one of the makers of it, and it looks like a gas can. It's amazing. So 1949, the People's Republic of China is born. Bum, bum, bum. With the elevation of the proletariat comes the elevation of their favorite drink, The state modernizes Chinese spirits, setting up regional distilleries throughout the country. Techniques that had only been passed down from master to apprentice are recorded and codified. Styles are sorted and classified. Production standards and quality rise. The national Baijiu brand grain prominence. Brands grain. I don't know what that is. But anyway, that's what we're drinking. So, bottoms up. It's good. It's kind of like, oh, I didn't mean that. I do mean it's good. I just haven't had it in a while. It's kind of like, if you ever had sake, it reminds me of that, but like to the extreme. It's like if everything, like the floral parts of it were more floral and the shoelace part of it was more shoelace. That's what it reminds me of when I taste it. And I love it. I think when you first try it, it's just going to be all gasoline and you're probably going to be coughing. That's what I did. But then after a while, I think you start to develop a little bit of a taste for it, or you can, and you start to taste some of the flowers and like the nice florally essence to it. It's quite nice. It's pretty nice. Anyway, here we go. I'm going to pour myself another little shot here. It's good. I save it for special occasions because I had to go all the way to New York City to get it and then had to drive it back down because I don't think you're allowed to ship alcohol. If you guys know differently, let me know. And I don't know anywhere in Florida that sells Baijiu. So it's a special occasion. This is a special occasion. Why? Because today we're talking about the goodness of God. We're talking about what is good. And that's hard. That's a hard. It's tricky. Defining good is tricky. Even when I looked it up, you know, when you look it up on the dictionary, I love when people start things like that. It's such a cliche. Dictionary defines love as. That's how you know you're set for a mediocre speech at a wedding. Sorry, everyone who's ever done that. Anyway, the dictionary defines goodness as an adjective. It is to be desired or approved of, as in a good quality of life or having the right qualifications. This is a good school. As a noun, it can be a benefit or advantage or something that is morally right or righteous. So you see the problem with that? This is the problem I have with it. What is good or advantageous depends on who is judging it. It's a little subjective. So there, I think that there is some subjectivity in judging something as good in a certain context, but not everything is subjective. Like the school example, it's like, yeah, there are qualifications that I care about that you might not care about. Or let's say even the alcohol, it's like, I think I like this Baijiu. So I'm going to say it's good, but someone else might taste it and be like, this is terrible. And they're missing out. They're missing out. I'll say that. But anyway, it's like there's that subjectivity that exists, and I think there's nothing wrong with that. I think that's good. I think that's right. But not everything can be subjective, especially when it comes to judging good. I think there's an unbiased side to that. There's a standard that exists, maybe. Maybe. I love how I say it, like, maybe. Not like I haven't been researching this for the past, you know, month. So this comes down to things where, yeah, you're free to have preference. You know, this music is good or this music is bad. Both aren't really wrong. So if we look at the subjectivity side of it, you know, where do we draw the line between subjective and objective? Objective. Music and food is one thing, but what about morality? That's something else that we saw in the definition here. You know, it can't be down to just preferences. Is it just the majority that decides what is good? Well, if you're Jean-Jacques Rousseau, then yes. His theory in The Social Contract is basically... If you never read it, it's a high school thing, so I doubt you read it. I didn't read it in high school. Took a test on it, passed the test, didn't read the book. That's a lie. Actually, I did read it. But I should, I kind of want to read it again. But anyway, his theory is, you know, if we set, basically, is if we set aside personal preferences and follow everyone's general will, then we can live in harmony by establishing moral rules of behavior. So his thing is basically, what everyone else, what the majority of people think, whatever most people think. But I have a problem with that idea still, and I think a lot of people do. And it's that sometimes the general will still isn't right. You know, we would disagree with it still. So to jump to the extreme example, God, you know I love my extremes. Hitler didn't happen alone. You know, he was voted in by millions of everyday people. So what happened in Nazi Germany was the general will. But we say that it isn't good. So is that because our general will outweighs theirs? You know, I think that's an interesting question. Is it just like whoever is the bigger majority? But then I was curious about that, and I was like, okay, well, let's look at that. As far as, you know, who decides what is right and what is not. And so when you look at the continent of Europe, there are 746.4 million people living in that continent. I think these numbers are from like 2022, I think. So last year, I think they're a year old. I have to say that so you guys know I'm not pulling random numbers out. And then in the U.S., there's about 333 million and about 40 million in Canada. So when you add all those up, Europe, the USA, and Canada, that equals... The reason I picked those three spots in particular is because that... Not everything falls in there, but to prove a point, it's kind of like that's the West, quote-unquote. There's places I'm sure I miss that share Western values, and I know there's countries in Europe that don't necessarily share Western values as we would consider them. But for the large part, I'm just kind of putting everyone together here. It proves a point. I'll get to it. So when you add all those up, that equals about 1.1 billion people. That's a lot of people. Now, when we look at the country of India alone, there are 1.4 billion people there. So how is their culture and general will not greater than ours? Shouldn't their ideals be right? Shouldn't it just doesn't add up to me. You know, shouldn't we be sharing their values since there are more people there? It's an interesting question. So basically the general will thing in my mind kind of just falls flat there. Where it's like, yeah, the numbers don't add up. There's something else going on here. And I think that's why we need a standard that doesn't change. You know, the idea of majority deciding what is good is the same as creating a ruler using different bases and calling them both an inch. If I'm like, oh, this is my inch and this is your inch, that would cause problems because our measurements probably wouldn't be the same. And we would call them the same thing. So it's like, oh, yeah, it's 4 inches. But when I measure it with my ruler, it's 17 inches. You know, there's a lot of issues that can happen there. An unchanging standard gives us the ability to determine what is right, regardless of what we think is right. And that's what's important. If I say that X is an inch, for example, but our standard says Y, then I know that I'm wrong. Why did I say it like that? I'm wrong. I'm wrong. It's bizarre. I don't know why I do the things I do. You have to live with this. But that shows me that I need correction. And that, yeah, that's, you get the point there. You get the point. So hopefully you can see where I'm going with this. Hopefully you can follow the path. The breadcrumbs I'm leaving here. So as we've discussed in previous episodes, God is unchanging, and he should be our standard. We change, and we are changing, but he is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And so I think that's what's so valuable and important and why we need something that we can look to. Because if our idea keeps changing, then what is good, you know, it's like trying to pin jello. It just goes all over the place. So I want to get real nerdy with you guys for a moment. And we're going to go back to one of my favorites. We're going to look at Genesis. Oh, Genesis. And I think that's big. I will say this might not be a new thought for a lot of you guys, but for me, viewing what I'm about to say in this way, it made me really excited. I've never really thought about it in this way in particular, and I was getting all giddy thinking about it and when I learned this. So let's jump into Genesis. Genesis 1:31. God calls what he created, everything that he created, the earth, the animals, you know, time, space, matter, all those things, he calls them very good. So now the Hebrew word for good is tov. I've heard tov, I don't know, but I'm going with that, what I said, and it'll probably be both. And this is used in the sentence as an adjective. It's an adjective, which means desirable, in order, or usable, or functional, if you will. So when God calls his creation very good, he's saying that it is very orderly or very functional. So what's important to mention here is that God did not create the earth. He didn't say it's perfect. He didn't create the earth perfect. The word for perfect in Hebrew is tamim. I'm very confident about that pronunciation. This is translated to complete, intact, unscathed, and it's often translated in the context of without blemish. When we look at like sacrifices and stuff, they say a lamb without blemish, attributing a sense of innocence to it. It is, you know, in no position to be killed, yet it is. It has no blemish. So it's important for this is to see that what God created was order. He said the earth is orderly. So we have tov, order, and the contrast to that is ra, which is often translated as evil, but used in, you know, in contrast, the Bible loves its contrasts. To tov, it's better translated as disorder or dysfunction. So when we look at the Garden of Eden, we have the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And I think we can probably better label this in light of this as the tree of the knowledge of order and disorder. You know, it's that full range. You know, the Bible loves God as the beginning and the end. He's the Alpha and the Omega. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. You know, it's this giving us this range in this full spectrum. Now, for you super nerds out there, I have read this in a few places, and I think a lot of scholars are on this side, that the title, The Tree of the Knowledge of Good and Evil, is actually a later addition to the text. The basis for this is that it's only used twice, and that's within the garden narrative. I think that's the only two places that I remember looking into that it was only in that story in the garden. Nowhere else in the Bible. In every other place in the Bible, the tree is mentioned. It is translated as the tree in the middle of the garden, or the tree which I commanded you not to eat from, or not to blah, 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 or even simply just the tree. Like the tree, you know what I'm talking about. And the title, I think, is still important because even though it may have been added later, it is derived from the narrative, and it kind of can make it easier to read, I think. By attributing this, it was. But that's speculation. There's really no. I don't think there's really hard evidence on that I've seen to say one way or the other. But it does help us, I think, with when we read the text to kind of see what's going on. But I think there's an interesting parallel that we can see from this when we look at it in these terms, and it's going back to Genesis 1:31. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Now, let's jump over to Genesis 3:6. Not too far, just a little jog. So when the woman, Eve, saw that the tree was good, she saw that the tree was good for food, .. It goes on. And I think what's really interesting when I look at this is these parallels are, you know, a constant theme in the Bible, and I think they're vital for us to pay attention to. It loves drawing, you know, this and this and these reversals. We see that with Jesus in terms of Israel. You know, he was able to succeed where Israel failed, and these really cool just parallels and constants. But I think what's important to bring out here, and I want to make sure I emphasize it, is God saw the woman, Eve. I'll just say Eve. Eve saw the woman. I'll get in trouble for a whole other reason. So God saw, Eve saw. God saw, and it was, he called it good. Eve saw and said it was good. Like, that's, I don't know, for me it's like, whoa. That brings out a whole nother level to this for me. And it's like, what happened there is beyond them just simply rebelling. God said, don't do this. And we're like, eh, screw you. Let's do it anyway. But it's that idea. It's like, what happened is, it's the temptation to determine for ourselves what is good and evil, what is order, what is disorder, apart from God. We decided to do it for ourselves. And I think what's interesting about this is that when I read it this way, it's we can't necessarily say that they didn't know what was right, what was wrong. They knew what was right and wrong according to God, but when they ate the fruit, they decided for themselves what was right and wrong. And I think that in part, this is really interesting because it can be viewed as kind of the start of culture. Culture is customs, arts, social institutions, and achievements, that's a dictionary definition, of a particular group of people. So when we determine for ourselves what is order and disorder, we can create a culture. That's what we're doing. We're creating a culture. And this can show itself on a small scale, like a family, to a large scale, or like an entire nation. And we see those different customs, those different arts, those different ideas spurn out of that to kind of create its own little ecosystem, I guess. So when God chose Israel as his people, what he was doing was resetting the standard of what is order and what is disorder. And as a Christian, that becomes our standard as well. I don't know. I find that fascinating, absolutely fascinating to look at it that way. And it might not be novel to anybody. They'd be like, yeah. But for me, I think that adds such an extra layer to the garden narrative. And it's something that I wouldn't have really known, I don't think, or thought about it in that way if it wasn't the time that I spent looking into it. And with that, I'm gonna go on a quick tangent for you guys here. With that, you know, I love doing this podcast. When I was on that break, I forgot how much I loved this. And because it's a good way for me to really focus on scripture and really dive deeper into it. And I want to raise the standard for you guys. I want to make sure that I'm bringing interesting topics and talking to interesting people for you guys, because I want this is for all of us to grow. We're truth seekers here, and I want to continue to seek that. Tipsy Theology started on the idea of, let's have people that, you know, disagree have a conversation. Let's talk about things that are maybe uncomfortable to talk about, or people don't like talking about it. And I want to continue that by, let's look into some topics maybe that wouldn't get touched or get kind of glossed over, or we're losing the meaning to it. Like, let's look into it a little bit more. You know, I'm not going to say that 100% of what I say on here is right. I want it. I hope it is. I don't want to be spreading wrong information, but it's that process of let's seek, let's look. And it takes a lot of energy because it's things that, you know, require a lot of brain power to be able to really look into it. And I'm a naturally energetic person. I typically wake up and I'm just ready to rock and roll. You know, I'm not a don't talk to me before I have my coffee kind of person. I don't know why I went with that accent. But between, you know, like all this preparation and stuff, it can be in, you know, work and friends and all this time. It's like, it can be kind of tiring. But I absolutely love it. I consider studying theology for me one of my favorite hobbies that I get to do. I definitely want to make sure that I have the energy to get the most out of it. And so I've been getting into the coffee hole a little bit lately. I was never really a coffee drinker. I was more of a tea drinker. Haha, jokes. I actually do love the taste of coffee now. But the caffeine really affects me. It allows me to get that extra energy and focus really hard for like 2 hours. And then impending doom and gloom and the world's going to end and I get really jittery and anxious. That's why I was excited. This company, Magic Mind, reached out to me. And after trying, they've got this little like 2 ounce shot that you drink with the caffeine. For me, it's coffee. And honestly, dude, what a game changer. I don't have that like ticking time bomb. Like, oh, I'm going to take a sip and then work hard before I go crazy. you know, the energy that I do get from the coffee is going to last. I don't really have those dips. I just have like a nice constant state of energy, and it allows me to be able to focus a little bit more, which is great, because then when I'm working on the podcast and putting my study time in for that, I know that I'm going to have consistent focus and study on that. My brain's not just going to randomly go insane from the caffeine crash. And the thing I love about it too is the ingredients in it are all natural, which I think is huge. You know, I would say it's a nice healthy addition to your coffee. So you tipsy theologians, you're probably up studying, and I think you can really benefit from having that energy to get the most out of your learning. It would really help me out too, and I would love it if you could give it a try. And to make it easier for you, you can get it at magicmind.com/tipsytheology with the discount code tipsy20. You can also get up to 56% off your first subscription or 20% off your one-time purchase. That's tipsy20, I know how to spell, TIPSY20, to save some cash money. It also works if you're ahead of the game and you're already a subscriber. You can save some money on your next subscription payment. Also, I do want to tell you guys, I am a sucker for good branding and packaging. Oh, man. And that's the thing I love about Magic Mind, too. When they sent me this package, it was like opening up a gift. And it was amazing. You open up this just like regular cardboard box, and inside, you know, you unfold the two flaps. It's not like a normal box. And it's like unwrapping a gift. Inside, they've got their branding and their really cool colors in there. Oh, it's tranquil. It's beautiful. And you got, yeah, everything you need is on there. I'm telling you, it's a full experience from buying to trying. I really do love it. So if you want to give it a try, highly encourage you to at least give it a try and see how it affects you. It's magicmind.com/tipsytheology with the discount code tipsy20. Now, I would recommend, if I was you, to look into the 30-pack. It's the best value. It comes out to like $3 a bottle, I think, somewhere in there, which is a really good price. So you can check out all these links in the description. So you should know this by now. I'll use any opportunity that I can to talk about Job. And this is no exception. For us to say that we know what goodness looks like, or in Job's case, what it looks like for God to run the world, that is us saying that we have a wide enough perspective on life to know how God should run the earth. So just like in Job's case, for us to say what is good and what is not is basically us saying that we understand enough about the universe to be the arbiter or the standard. And that's just not the case. You know, we're limited beings at the end of the day. We are limited to time, space, and matter. We really only have the capacity to understand things that exist within those three standards, time, space, and matter. In order for us to understand something that is outside of those limitations, some kind of abstract idea like love or go on from there, you know, or even hate, it's like we need to form them into something limited, into something that exists within time, space, and matter. That's the only way for us to explain something that's abstract, is for us to put it within those categories. Like if someone's angry, this happens to me all the time too. You know, you ask questions because you want to put it into something that we can understand. someone's like, I'm really mad at that person. Okay, why? Because the idea of itself, we can't really comprehend it inside of that. It's interesting because I think we can feel some of those things. Like when we love someone, we can feel those feelings, but we can't understand it until we put it in within, you know, those three categories, and add some substance to it, if you will, make it more tangible. And so similarly, we can't understand God outside of what he has revealed to us inside time, space, and matter. Because we are limited to this, I think it's safe to ask, who are we to say whether he, God, is or is not good? What we can narrowly look at as wrong might zoom out to be good, or vice versa. And don't think I chose the Baijiu today. You didn't think I was going to not say it again, did you? You're out of your mind. I'm going to say it again. Baijiu. Well, one of the reasons I chose this drink today was because I'm going to share a Chinese proverb. And what better way to do that than while enjoying one of their favorite drinks?
Oh, that one hit different.
Woo! All right, so the proverb goes like this. A farmer and his son had a beloved stallion who helped the family earn a living. One day, the horse ran away and their neighbors exclaimed, "Your horse ran away. What terrible luck." The farmer replied, "Maybe so, maybe not. We'll see." And a few days later, the horse returned home, leading a few wild mares back into the farm as well. The neighbors shouted, "Your horse has returned," and brought several horses home with him. "What great luck." And the farmer replied, "Maybe so, maybe not. We'll see." Later that week, the farmer's son was trying to break in one of the mares, and she threw him to the ground, breaking his leg. The villagers cried, "Your son broke his leg. What terrible luck." And the farmer replied, "Maybe so, maybe not. We'll see." So a few weeks later, soldiers from the National Army marched through town, recruiting all able-bodied boys for the army. They did not take the farmer's son, still recovering from his injury. And the villagers shouted, "Your boy is spared. What tremendous luck." To which the farmer replied, "Maybe, maybe so, maybe not. We'll see." And so the moral here, I think, is great perspective on what we're talking about, is we don't have a full enough perspective to judge whether or not something is truly good or truly bad. We just don't have the whole story. And same way in Job, we have Behemoth and Leviathan, two fantastic examples of this. You know, these creations are depicted as symbols of danger and disorder. They're huge. They cause problems. They wreak havoc. However, they're not evil. God says that they're part of his good creation. In Job 40:15, God says, "Behold, Behemoth, which I made as I made you." And we know that he created man very good, very orderly. And so Behemoth is part of that order in the way God created it. The world that God created was good, orderly, and beautiful, but it's not perfect. It's also wild and it's dangerous. Now, that doesn't mean that what God created was flawed. By no means is what that means, but that it was not designed to prevent those dangers. So, I mean, we can ask the question, you know, why do we have pain receptors if we were never supposed to have a reason to feel pain? Some people might argue that that was post-fall. You know, that was like something that came about later. I don't really subscribe to that personally. The reason for that is because it's not like pain isn't a bad thing. For us to feel pain is a good thing, because it helps us to prevent future pain. But I think that's what's interesting in the fact that, you know, what God created order. He created good, a good earth. He created good things inside the earth. He created it orderly. But within that, he did not prevent the ability to suffer. And that's a tough one. that seems very counterintuitive. And it's very confusing and it's complicated, which God makes it very clear that it is. Within Job, we read that, yeah, it's confusing and complicated because we don't have the capacity to take in the full story. Will we one day? Maybe. Maybe not. You know, we are limited inside of what we can know and what we can do. And I think we have to ask the question then, it's like, so who do we trust? And when I look at my own life, I can't even decide what's good for myself. I have trouble making decisions that benefit me sometimes. I'm supposed to convince myself that I'm the standard for right and wrong, for order and disorder. So then, since then I'm out of the running of what the standard is, should I look over to somebody else? Everyone else, you're in the same boat as me. There's some aspect of our life. You know, we can't decide what's good for ourselves. We make bad decisions. And I think that if we all could be the standard, if one of us could be the standard, our lives would look very, very different than they do. And I don't think we have to be too, we don't have to look too intrinsically to say that's true. So if that's the case, we have to look outside of ourselves to find someone who exceeds where we fail. And that's where we look at, I think, in Scripture. We look at Jesus in the Gospels, and we see that he is victorious where we fall short, where Israel fell short. He succeeds in those. And God is not limited in the ways that we are. He created everything and exists beyond them. We change, he does not. We are inconsistent, he is not. He succeeds where we often fall short. And so that brings it down to the question of what is good then? And that's a great question. And it's a hard one to answer because we don't have the full story. We don't have what we need to truly to say, this is good and this is bad. This is order, this is disorder. We can't make those judgments outside of what God has told us is orderly, is good, and is disorderly, is bad. To make those judgments, we have to look at what Scripture tells us. We have to be in prayer to speak with the Holy Spirit and say, what is what? And we've been given a guideline, a guide to follow to make general decisions on what is orderly and what is disorderly. And we can follow that. We can extrapolate and make judgments and apply it in different aspects of our life. But there are things sometimes that fall beyond that. And just in Job's case, we are not equipped. We are not smart enough. We are not beyond our own limitations. We don't have the story to say this is good, this is bad. We haven't read the full story. We don't know it. We can't know it. So we have to look at the person who does. You know, we have to look at the narrator in a way. And I'm not saying he's this cosmic, you know, puppeteer. But what I'm saying is that he is the standard. He is good. He is order. And so if we follow the will that he has, the order that he has created for us, we're going to be on a good path. And when I look at it from this perspective, of what is orderly, what is disorderly, the just infinite confusion about it, but then the simplicity that points us to trust the Lord, trust the guidance of the Holy Spirit. I'm not good at it. My mind is a lot louder and I think my ideas are a lot better. And every time they're not as good as I think they should be. if I would have just followed what the Spirit was prompting me to. And yeah, when I look at it from that perspective, I want to end with this. And it's Psalm 34:8. O taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. And all I can say is amen to that. The Lord is good. He is order. And blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. Blessed is the man who trusts him. And so at the end of the day, the question can really only be answered in trust the Lord. What's the will that God has for you? That is good. Because God is good. And we need to rely on him. We need to trust him in order to see, in order to know what is good. So thank you guys so much for listening. This has been one of my favorites to research into and to talk about. And I look forward to continuing this journey with you guys as we continue to seek truth. And I'll talk to you guys, hopefully sooner rather than later.